Institute. I'm going to tell you about, so this is the title of my talk, QCD and a holographic model of hadrons. So I will try to first describe, this work in collaboration with George Derrish, William and Mary, Amy Katz at Stanford, and Michel Chepan of the University of Illinois in Chicago. And there is also another paper which describes a very similar model, like the model that we will be considering. So, my talk hopefully will be short and painless, and I will try as if not to advocate as much the model that we are considering as try to motivate that we should be looking for a connection between QCD and the hyperdimensional theory. We know that QCD is the correct theory of strong interactions from various experiments. Like an elastic scattering experiment. It's a theory that is asymptotically free. That is, if you consider processes with where the exchange momentum is much bigger than the scale for lambda QCD, which is about 200 MeV, for these processes we can use perturbation theory. The effective strong coupling constant alpha s is much more than 1. At high Euclidean momenta. On the other hand, if you try to go to lower momenta, Q square or the lambda QCD square, then we have a problem that the strong coupling constant becomes about 1, and we don't have the control perturbation here. And moreover, we know that at low energy, the theory as observed is very different from the theory as we write out on paper. The Lagrangian of QCD that we write down is in terms of quark field and gluon field, while the observed particles are hadrons, combinations of quark and gluons. So there is a problem of confinement which doesn't have an analytic solution. So there is a long hope that an analytic solution of QCD or some simplified version of QCD like large M QCD can be found, and the most promising thing to look at is actually string theory. So historically, string theory appeared as been proposed first as a theory of strong interactions. And I was trying to think about what kind of phenomenology can that string theory explain, and I came up only with volume one. That is, it can explain Ricci trajectories, that is, why particles with different spins and the same quantum number seems to lie on a straight line if you plot spin as a function of square mass of this particle. So J, which is the spin of this particle, is proportional to M squared, and the proportionality coefficient called alpha prime, which is of order 1 GV squared in for the hadronic Ricci trajectories. So this, the string theory as a theory of strong interaction has been abandoned for a long time. But recently, the Mandasina conjecture has revived some hope that we can find an analytic solution to QCD. Mandasina's conjecture says that there is a connection between any two forces, the Young-Mills theory and type 2B string theory on ATS5 process 5. So on one side of the duality, you have a form of field theory. On this side, which is in some sense a gauge theory, but is very different from QCD, has no asymptotic freedom, has no confinement. However, it's a gauge theory, and it is conjectured to be dual to string theory. So we have at least one example where string theory can describe field theory. Now, the N-equal force of the Young-Mills theory is very different from QCD, but people have been trying to approach QCD from this theory, N-equal force of the Young-Mills theory, and I call that approach a top-down approach. You start from a theory with a lot of symmetry, a conformal field theory, and you try to add to perturb this theory and tweak it so that it become somewhat similar to QCD. You can add terms that break supersymmetry, you can break conformal invariance, and you end up sometimes with theories that share some features common to QCD, for example, but finally. So in this talk, I will describe another approach, which is somewhat less systematic, but is complementary to the bottom-up approach, to the top-down approach. That is what I call here the bottom-up approach. That is, instead of taking any force of the Young-Mills theory as a starting point, we start from experimental data. We look at what we know about hadron phenomenology and try to build a theory, a hyperdimensional theory that would have the features that we want. And then we can compute several things and compare with experiments. And I want to advertise in advance that we will see that even the simplest model that we build using this approach can reproduce surprisingly well experimental data. It's worked much better than one has any right to hope. Okay, so is there any question? No? Okay, so let's start from hadronic phenomenology. So, if you look at the particle data group, then most of the particle data book, then most of the book is devoted to hadrons. So at first sight, it looks like a mess. There are hundreds of resonances that have many decay channels with masses that seem completely random. But at the closer look, you can see several features of hadronic physics, at least at low energy, that are very seems to be telling us something. First of all, we have patterns, we have resonances, and the resonances are relatively narrow. For example, if I take the lone mesons, that is vector particles consisting of two quarks that carries an isospin, the mass of the lone meson is about 770 MeV. And its width is about 150 MeV. So this is a very typical hadronic resonance. It's not narrow, but it's not wide either. So the width is somewhat small compared to the mass. This feature we can understand as a consequence of the fact that the number of color in nature, 3, is bigger than 1. We can consider 3 to be much bigger than 1. The width of a hadronic resonance is suppressed by the power of Nc, the number of color. And that's why for all the resonances, many of the resonances, we see a smaller width compared to its energy. Okay. The second thing that we need to know about hadron is that chiral symmetry is spontaneously broken. In QCD, if you take all the quark masses to zero, then there is a global symmetry SUNF cross SUNF. SUNF left cross SUNF right. You can rotate left-handed quark and right-handed quarks independently, and the Lagrangian is symmetric under this rotation in the limit of massless quarks. And that symmetry is broken spontaneously to a diagonal SU and F, which give rise to a light pseudo-Bronson boson called the pions. If NF is equal, consider NF equal 2, I have 3 pions. If the quark masses were exactly 0, then the pion would have 3 exactly masses. But in fact, quark masses are small, so that these pions have a small mass, 140 MeV, that is much smaller than the mass of the next resonance, which is the Romney ones we consider above. Okay, another consequence of ferrite symmetry breaking is that the hadronic resonance is not organized in multiplex of the complete SUNF cross SUNF group. One can classify the resonances in terms of the diagonal SUNF group that is not unbroken. So, for example, the Rho mesons is a triplet in terms of the SU2 isospin, SU2 diagonal group. But there is no degeneracy that corresponds to the original SUNF cross SUNF group. So we can say that there is a mass splitting between different SUNF multiplets that carries opposite parities. For example, the A1 vector boson, which is very similar to the Rho meson but has an opposite parity, has a mass 1230 MeV, which is different from the mass of the Rho meson. And one can attribute the difference of the masses to the fact that chiral symmetry is spontaneously broken by the vacuum. Now, another feature of hadronic physics that we don't know how to explain is that for some reason quark models work better than one should expect. So we know that there is confinement, the quarks are massless, it is bounded in hadrons. But for some reason one can treat this hadron as a collection of constituent quarks. And quark models work in a way that we don't understand. One of the consequences of this is that for light mesons I can put a correspondence between the hadrons and an operator that consists of a quark and an anti-quark. For example, I can associate the pion of QCD to the operator Q bar gamma phi tau A Q. Q is the doublet and tau A here is the Pauli matrix. Is the Pauli matrices. The Rho mesons can be associated with the vector currents. Vector isospin current in the A1 meson can be associated with this operator, the axial vector term. So the association works the following way. If I take the vacuum and then add this operator on the vacuum, then I will create a state that has non-zero overlap with the one particle state. So if I take this operator, act in the vacuum, then I create a pion. Plus a superposition of mini particle state. Okay, and that will be interesting for us because it is reminiscent of the ESCFT correspondence between an operator in the bulk and an operator in the boundary theory and a field in the bulk. Okay, and another feature of low-energy hadronic physics that has a long, long history from the 60s, but has never found an adequate explanation in terms of QCD is vector meson dominance. So, in the simplest formulation, vector meson dominance tells that if we try to couple, say, a gamma photon to a pion, then this coupling can be approximated very well by this diagram where the photon first becomes a Rho meson and then the Rho meson is coupled to the pions. Okay. say one of the consequences of this vector meson dominance is that if I take the momentum of the photon to zero, then on the left hand side I have just the charge of the ion, which is 1. And on the right hand side I have a combination of the so-called decay constant of the rho meson, which is the coupling between the rho and the gamma, the photon, the probability that this photon will turn into a rho meson, multiplied to the vortex of coupling between the rho meson and the three pions, and divided by the propagator of the rho meson, which is in the which is 1 over n q squared in the low momentum limit. So each of these terms can be checked, can be measured experimentally. And rho is just the location of the rho pole. In scattering amplitude, the F rho can be measured from, can be computed from the probability of a rho decay into a U plus E minus pair. And that is very well established decay channel of the rho meson. And from that, on time, the decay constant, F rho, decay constant of the rho mesons. And the coupling between the rho and the pions can be found by looking at the probability of rho meson to decay into two pions. The rho meson, the dominant decay channel of rho meson is into two pions, which is 150 MeV, which I mentioned before. And from that, we find that the coupling constants were around 6. And we can plug all this number into this relation, and we see that it works very well. So that is something that has been known for a long time, but has never been understood. And we even don't know whether there is any, in principle, there is any explanation on CD. So now, okay. So now we take this bottom-up approach, and we want to build a holographic model which would exhibit some features of QCD. So we have a five-dimensional space, and for the lack of imagination, we take just the ADS for a moment. Just try the simplest model with the S squared equal 1 over Z squared combination. So Z is the radial coordinate, R is the curvature of the ADS space, and for simplicity, sometimes we will just take R, put R equal 1. So we know that the ADS space in the five-dimensional side of the duality correspond to conformal symmetries in the four-dimensional theory. And we also know that QCD is not a conformal field theory. But so we hope that there is a so-called conformal window of QCD that in some range of momentum QCD we have as if there was a conformal symmetry. Okay. So conformal window has been talked about before, and I just take it as that. Okay, just for, because I don't have any better idea of what is the five-dimensional metric. And then I have to model confinement. Confinement, we know that the theories that exhibit confinement all have a feature that space-time ends at some radius. So here I just cut off, truncate a ES5 state space at some radial coordinate z equals z max, zn. So it is, of course, a very simplistic model of confinement, but I just don't have anything better. And then at z equals zm, I impose some boundary condition on my field, like a Neumann boundary condition. And then I will see, I will automatically get a discrete hadronic spectrum mimicking confinement of QCD.
Is your result crucial what boundary condition you impose there? How
there is, we have to impose which invariant boundary condition, and it actually limits your u to, in the simple space, limit u to the normal boundary condition. The Dirichlet will, I don't know how to impose it in the, for the Gauss field, I don't know how to impose that in the Gauss invariant. Okay, now, what about chiral symmetry? We know that chiral symmetry is very important, so we have to build this, the properties of chiral symmetry into our five-dimensional model. Chiral symmetry means that we have two set of conserved charges, two set of conserved kernels, J mu left and J mu right, which in the limit of mass test quarks have vanishing divergence. So, using the IDSTFT dictionary, we know that in the five dimensional theory there have to be two gauge fields, a mu left and a mu right. And they have to be massless because the currents are conserved currents, for example, the R charge current in any proportion for Young Mills theory correspond to the massless gauge field in five dimensional supercurrent. Also, we have to break this chiral symmetry. In QCD, the spontaneous breaking of chiral symmetry is due to the condensate, the chiral condensate Q. And if I put this index, flavor index, on top of the quark, the Q is actually an F by an F matrix, which in the vacuum has an expectation value that is diagonal in the flavor space. So in order to have chiral symmetry breaking in our model, we have to introduce the bulk scalar, which also has two indices, left-hand index alpha and the right-hand index beta, or vice versa. And it has to be a bi-fundamental scalar in terms of the SUNF and process UNF H field. Okay? So that we know an operator in QCD is important for phenomenology, and then we use the operator field correspondence and introduce the field in the five-dimensional model. Now we know that the mass of field corresponds to the dimension of the corresponding operator or scalars. You have this formula delta. If delta is the dimension of the operator you want to consider, then the mass of the bulk field has to be delta multiplied by delta minus 4, by r squared. I put r equal 1 here. Now, in QCD, the naive dimension of the operator q is 3. So the simplest thing to do is to neglect all anomalous dimension, take 3 as the exact dimension of the operator q, and then postulate that my x field has the mass, which is minus 3 in unit of 1 over r squared. Okay?
So yeah. The dimension is 3 in the asymptotically 3 regime, right?
The dimension of the operator q is 3. But very large, it will be a large Q squared. Yeah. And there is a correction, anomalous dimensional correction that is the series over alpha s. But we just throw away all this correction.
So is this below the VF bound minus 3?
The VF bound is minus 4. Minus 4. So it's above the VF. VF bound is achieved when delta is equal to 2. Okay, now, chiral symmetry breaking means that we have to give a non-zero expectation value for our scalar field x. So the dynamics should be such that the expectation value of x is non-zero already in the vacuum. We know that a small z for an operator of a scalar field with mass minus 3, I can expand it in power of z, of small z. Small z correspond to ultraviolet. For small z, I have term proportional to z and term proportional to z cubed. Now, again, from the idea, from our knowledge of ADS-CFT correspondence, we can associate the coefficient in front of the z, the dominant term, the z term, as the quad mass, the explicit breaking of parasymmetry, the operator, the coefficient in the operator that is present in the Lagrangian that breaks parasymmetry. So MQ should be proportional to the quad masses, and the coefficient in front of the z cubed term here should be proportional to the chiral condensate. Sigma is proportional to Q bar Q, which is the effect of one includes the effect of explicit chiral symmetry breaking, and the other term includes the effect of continuous chiral symmetry breaking. Okay, so all the ingredients of the model is now present. So I just limit myself to a simple, simplest possible Lagrangian that has chiral symmetry breaking in confinement. That is a theory where I have a five-dimensional Lagrangian of two SUNF, five-dimensional SUNF which field. It's A left and A right, and F left and F right are the field strength that is constructed from the field F, from the potential A left and A right. The X field is a scalar field, which is bi-fundamental in terms of A left and A right. So the covariant derivative of the X field has this form, with A left acting on the left and A right acting on the right. And the mass of this scalar field is 3, minus 3. Okay? And the whole theory is living in a truncated ADS space, and Z runs from 0 to some maximal value of Zm. Okay, the X background ideally should arise dynamically, but we simply will take this X to be Z plus 2Q. Just postulate that there is a non-zero background.
I'm sorry, so you basically impose chiral symmetry breaking by hand?
You impose chiral symmetry breaking by hand. We don't have any good picture how a compelling way to break chiral symmetry spontaneously. So then I impose boundary condition of z equals zm. So I take the field strength Fc, the electric field, Fc mu is equal to 0, Fc equals Zm, which in the Az equals 0 gauge, which means that I impose non-member condition for the field potential. And I would impose some boundary condition for X field, say, here I impose just a normal boundary condition on the fluctuation of my field.
Do you decouple gravity?
So gravity is thrown away.
Decoupled.
Well, it is not here. So we are discussing a model. So if there is a string theory that is behind this model, there should be a gravity field. And you know that QCD contains have blue balls, should have blue balls that correspond to this to the gravity. The reason why we don't consider gravity here is that blue balls are never important phenomenologically. They are very high in masses and very hard to see. So as a first approximation, we just freeze the metric. So I will mention that at the end of this talk.
This X background is a solution?
So it's a solution to the free mass, massive field equation for the X. So the equation for X have a lot of solutions, and we just postulate that there is some additional mechanism that would choose, that would break parasymmetry and choose this background. it's just a parameterization of the.
Like there are two integration constants for the field Laplace field of the appropriate mass, and those are integration constant m sub q and c. And so he just chooses that to be known.
So the mq has to be mapped. Yes. Okay.
And the z plus z q form is a solution.
Yeah.
A solution is the
it's just free.
It's not a full solution. Those are just the two first.
But for the ADS, your metric is just ADS. It is.
You can put solutions. There are no more terms. There is no more.
Zero momentum. That's
or it's zero momentum.
Yeah.
Okay.
Zero momentum.
Okay.
But strictly speaking, I'm cheating here because this solution doesn't obey the boundary condition that I want to impose, which is e x equals 0. So I'm saying that let me choose this solution and then you put a condition on the fluctuation of the phase field that would be interesting. So that is where, in principle, I can impose a different boundary condition, say, no number of conditions. Okay, so now the model have four free parameters, the block mass, the two parameters that include parasymmetry breaking MQ sigma, the cutoff of the AGS space, and the five-dimensional gauge coupling G5. And one should compare that to the three free parameters of QCD, MQ, lambda QCD, and NC. And the reason why we have more parameter is that because we don't have a dynamical mechanism for parasymmetry breaking. This parameter sigma here should in principle be related to the scalar confinement. Okay, so now there is a very important thing that interesting that one can do here is to match the operator product expansion in the two theory. So let me illustrate that in the example of the vector current. So the vector current is the sum of left-handed current and right-handed current. It's the isospin current in QCD. We have a five-dimensional theory that contains the global symmetry, so we can compute using the previous EFT prescription the correlator of two currents. So the way we do that is to follow the what we are taught. So we solve the classical equation of motion for the gauge field that corresponds to that current. So we do that in momentum space. We do a momentum Fourier transformation with respect to the four space-time coordinates. And then we impose the boundary condition that this V is equal to V0, which is the boundary value of the gauge field. And then we differentiate the action with respect to twice with respect to that boundary value of the gauge field. So at the quadratic level, we can just write the action as the boundary terms, like this. And then what come out from all this calculation is that we find the Fourier transformation of the current-current correlator, which is, of course, transverse because the current is conserved. The coefficient here, I single out here the transverse Lorentz structure. This pi V, I will call it the polarization. Then the polarization operator, so the polarization operator is equal to the derivative of the solution to the equation of motion with the boundary condition that is equal to 1 at the boundary. So it's just a straightforward AES-CFT calculation following the prescription. The only thing that we have to do is to solve this, try to find a solution to this equation with a boundary condition that's E equals 0 and with a normal boundary condition that's E equals ZM and then plug it into this formula, we will find the polarization operator. Now, for large, but so, and this polarization operator depends on the momentum Q squared. So let's consider Q squared to be Euclidean, that is, space-like. For large space-like Q squared, the solution to the field equation is almost insensitive to the boundary condition that we put at z equals n, at the infrared. And that is because at large Q, the solution is concentrated in the region of z of order 1 over Q. As Q goes to infinity, the region where this v, this solution is non-zero, is becomes very small. At z much bigger than 1 over z, 1 over Q, the solution is essentially zero, it's exponentially small. So it's very insensitive of the boundary condition we put at z equals n. So at large Q squared, the polarization tensor can be computed just by solving the equation exactly, and that is the solution. And then we will find that it's 1 over 2 Q5 squared log Q squared. Well, log Q squared because it's a consequence of conformal symmetry, and G5, 1 over G5 squared because we have to differentiate the action with respect to the boundary condition. And the action has one, has an overall 1 over G5 squared in front. Now, on the other hand, we know how to compute this correlation function in QCD at large Q squared. We need just to evaluate the one loop diagram, where inside I have a fourth loop. And the result is that pi v is equal to nc over 24 pi squared log Q squared. Okay. And nc is just because there are nc possible colors of quarks that can run inside this one loop graph. So by matching these two formula, we can establish the correspondence between the five-dimensional gauge coupling and the number of color in the theory that we run tomorrow, QCD. So from that, we will see that this implies that the coupling between mesons in our model is down by a factor of 1 over nc, as expected from the other one.
So in this calculation of pi v q squared, you get log q squared means that log q squared zm squared, right? I mean, the dimension of the log is...
There is, you can add a term, you can, in principle, it has to be a dimensionless argument in the log. So, but the thing you have is always a contact term, constant, you add to the polarization tensor. So in QCD, if you go to higher loops, then you will have, say you draw a gluon line here, you will modify this coefficient by, so this will, you will pick up a coefficient, one, this will be multiplied to 1 plus alpha s over half. So the next, you will have the alpha s correction. Okay, so we reduce the number of three parameter in our theory to three. So at the beginning we have four, and then we relate the five dimensional gauge coupling to the number of color of QCD. Now, we want to describe hadrons. The vector mesons of QCD, like the row mesons, in fact, if you look at the particle data loop, there are a row, and then there are higher excitations of the row with the same quantum number of higher mass. Then we identify this row meson with the normalizable modes. So for normalizable modes of the five-dimensional equation. So we write down the same equation that we wrote down before for the gauge field, for the transverse component of the gauge field, and we impose the boundary condition. Now we impose different type of boundary conditions. That is, psi has to be vanishing at z equals 0. And it obeys the normal boundary condition at z equals the n. So it's a true blue-view type of problem. There are a discrete set of eigenmodes of these equations, which we can characterize by the index n, the n from 0, 1, 2, 3, 2, etc. And we can normalize the solution to 1. Now, as well, this eigenmode of the differential equation is that we can write out the propagator in terms of this normalizable mode. It's just the usual theorem in the theory of Green's function. We write down, we can write the bulk to bulk propagator as sum over the eigen, the normalizable mode divided by two squared minus n squared. Okay. Now, one can prove that the non-normalizable modes that we need to compute the two-point correlation function is related to that bulk-to-bulk propagator in a very simple way. We take the derivative with respect to one variable and then set this variable to zero. So we can derive a formula that relates the polarization operator we computed before for h q squared, and now we can relate that for any value of q squared to a sum over the normalizable mode. Sum over different n of this structure. But now, if I now go back to the QCD, picture, this is just a sum over harmonic resonance. I have a current, two-point correlation, current-current correlation sandwiched between the two vacuum states. So this two-point correlation function would be a sum over of the intermediate state that are my vacuum mesons. And the coefficient in the numerator, so this is just the propagator of these vacuum mesons, and the coefficient here is just the matrix element between the of the current between the vacuum state and the one particle state, which is the decay constant of the vector meson. So now I derive a formula that relates the decay constant of the vector meson with a property of the normalizable mode corresponds to. So if I can solve the equations, then I find the normalizable mode, then I define the decay constant of the meson, which is experimentally determined. So let's try for the lowest rho meson. So we know the experimental value for the mass of the rho meson, 7.76 MeV, and that fits the value of Zm. That is because when we solve this wave equation, we find the solution to be a Bessel function. And the mass of the lowest rho meson is just the root of the lowest root of J0 divided by Zm, so then it fits Zm in our model. And the first normalizable mode has the form of the Z multiplied to Jc to J1, the Bessel function, and we can normalize it multiplied to some normalization factor. So we know the normalizable mode, we can compute the derivative near z equals 0, and that derivative multiplied 1 over g5 squared will give us the decay constant of the rho meson. But we also know from the OPE matching before that this five-dimensional gauge coupling is simply proportional to nc with the known proportionality coefficient. Okay, so from that we find the value of the decay constant of the rho to be 329 MeV. Now, experimentally again, this rho is extracted, can be extracted from the decay rho going to E plus E minus, which has this vortex proportional to F rho, and it's proportional also to the electromagnetic constant. So if we compute that, we compare the experiment, we find that the experimental value of F rho should be 340 MeV. Which is very close to the value that we have found before. So the agreement here is simply excellent. It's better than anything one could hope for. Now, we can go further and consider the axial sector, that the sector that coupled the left minus right gauge field and the phase of the scalar x. And then this sector is a little bit more complicated because I have a couple of equations. The equation between, there is one equation that decouples, that is the equation for the transverse part of a left minus a right, and that applies to the tower A1 ion mesons, and there are a couple of equations between the, that couples the phase of X and the longitudinal part of the H field. And these two equations need the tower of the high mesons, including the lowest number bonds from bottom. And from this equation, I can determine the mass of the A1, the decay constant of the A1, the mass of the pion, the decay constant of the pi. And I can also prove the Gamma-Hoplinger relation that is the mass of the pion squared should be proportional to the flat mass. And it goes to zero as the flat mass goes to zero. Okay, I also can compute the coupling between different mesons. In general, it is given, this coupling is given by some overlapping the globe. So for example, the coupling between the rho meson and the pions in these models arises from the covariant derivatives of the X field. So if I expand this term in the Lagrangian, I will find that G rho pi pi can be expressed in terms of some integral with some measure, some product of normalizable modes, the pion normalizable mode and the rho meson normalizable mode. And in this picture, it is very, there is a very interesting interpretation of the phenomenon of vector meson dominance. That is, if I compute, if I try to compute the coupling of an external current, which is denoted by the photon here, then the coupling of a photon between two mesons, A and B, generically would be an integral with some measure of the product of the wave function, the normalizable mode psi A and psi B that correspond to these two mesons, multiplied to the non-normalizable modes that is the external current here. But, and the coupling between rho mesons with A and B is a similar expression where instead of the non-normalizable mode, I have a normalizable mode. But I can expand the non-normalizable mode in a series of over the normalizable mode. And this series will be, if we have here z equals zero, but in general this can be done. And so I can express the coupling of the gamma of the photon to the hadron as sum over resonances in this model. And in practice, it turned out, for example, in this model, that this sum is dominated by the first one or two terms. So it is a very nice we have a emergence of the vector meson dominance in the coupling between the photon and the hadron, just appearing from the mathematics of non-normalizable and normalizable modes.
Excuse me. So why couldn't the same argument be made in QCD itself? Because rho was the lightest vector meson which could go to gamma and
yes. So in QCD, if you try to write down a Lagrangian, so we say let's we know that in QCD we can write the effective Lagrangian in terms of the mesons. And we have, we can consider coupling of the gamma, say, with two pions. And then there must be contribution from the rho mesons. But one cannot forbid a term that couple directly the photon with the pion. So this term cannot be forbidden by symmetry. Here, in this framework, it just doesn't appear in the formalism. So in terms, at the level of the effective Lagrangian, you cannot forbid that term. You have to go to an additional argument that the form factor has to go to zero as the momentum of the photon goes to infinity. Then you can forbid this.
In case of QCD, electromagnetic effect is weak compared with strong current, right? So in some sense, second diagram already is the first, right?
No, it doesn't. because the second diagram is the same order as this diagram, because the E appear both on here and here. So now if I use my model and then compute all the quantity that I can compute, then I have this the second. Okay, so don't pay attention to myself. Okay, so it's just a different set of parameters, but somehow. So the model. So in the model calculation, we need to fix three parameters, and we have to choose three from this set. Say I choose the most. I choose m pi, m rho, and f pi. These are the parameters that are determined most accurately by experiments, and then I can predict the other four. And you can see here that the prediction is not that bad at all. It's at the level of 10%. Well, this last column we tried a different set of parameters that try to optimize someone and then to get the result that is not obviously better than this column. Okay, so more things that one can do here is that we can improve, say, the enlarged chiral symmetry from an n equal 2 to an n equal 3, consider strange measurements for kaons. K-star can try to do chiral anomaly, include the Chern-Simons term in the five-dimensional action and compute different processes. We can consider baryons, which will be skirmions in this picture. And in principle, we can also improve on blue balls. And the blue balls, there are spin 2 blue balls that correspond to the gravitons mode, and there can be spin 0 blue balls that correspond to a massless scalar field, for example, or could be the dilaton. Okay, so what did we learn from doing that for these exercises? So we learned that even the simplest five-dimensional model that have chiral symmetry in it work surprisingly well. Chiral symmetry is very important for that to work. We also learned that there is a very interesting OPE matching, operator product expansion matching, that help us to eliminate one parameter from the model. Namely, we can express the five-dimensional gauge coupling in terms of the number of color, and there is an interesting question of whether that matching can be extended beyond the leading logarithm. So IV in QCD, for IV in QCD there is this term, there are perturbative RPS corrections, but there are also non-perturbative so-called power corrections that are parameterized by the so-called gluon condensate and the quark condensate, Q1Q. And GPU mu squared average over the vacuum. So these are for power correction because they decay like power in Q, but they are important. And we can try to match this exact formula, large Q squared, to a sum over hadronic resonances. So this technique has been actually tried before in QCD without doing any five-dimensional physics, and that is called the QCD sum rule technique developed by Schumann, Weinstein, Zakharov in 79, and it works relatively well. So there might be a holographic version of the SPZ sum rule. And I want to speculate on whether that we can go beyond the five-dimensional field theory and try to build an effective string theory that lives in closed space. There are a lot of unexplained features of QCD that even now we don't have any answer to. We have seen that vector measure dominance may be explained in some sense by the fact that the mechanisms correspond to the gauge fields in the bulk which couple minimally to the scalar sum to other particles. Now, there are these unexplained features that seem to tell us about the existence of a string theory for QCD. There are a few of them. Firstly, the intercept of the low trajectory is close to 1/2 experimentally. So if you try to build a Venusiano type amplitude of the scattering of mesons and impose the condition that the scattering amplitude goes to zero, because pions have to be a Goldstone boson, then you will see that the amplitude you can build would have to have intercept the row trajectory from 1/2. Okay. And experimentally it's close to 1/2. So there might be something here. Another feature of QCD that might not be explainable is that if I take the difference of mass square between the single scalar mesons and the vector mesons, say the rho and phi, and then if I have strange quark B star and K, if I have charm quark, it is B star and B, and if I have bottom quark, B star and B. These mass square differences are almost unchanged if I change the mass of the heavy quark. It's the same for the bottom, well, with the level of 20% accuracy, it's the same for the bottom quark with the completely light quark meson. So it's completely unexplainable. And there is also another interesting thing that I think could be related to string theory, such as the suppression of having a twist effect in keeping elastic scattering, but I have only very vague idea about that. So I hope that this model is just a motivation for us to try and understand the features of conjecture string theory towards the QCD.
So you mentioned that feral symmetry grading is important. Now you have two parameters, and one is explicit and the other one is spontaneous. Mm-hmm. So do you need both of these parameters?
I need both of these parameters.
So what will happen if I put mass of the quark to zero?
Putting the mass of the quark to zero doesn't do much, actually. You just make the final mass less. For other quantity, I need for if I forget about the final mass, then I need just the parameter C. So the quark mass is even in QCD, quark mass is a parameter completely independent of other things. You can tune the final mass of anything you want.
Yeah. So, any relation to how a top down could have taken real kind of effective?
So there is a paper by Sukimoto and Sakai, and they consider a brain construction of EAT8-bar brain that have very somewhat similar features to this. The only thing that is missing is that operator of the dimension 3, that's a few x. So they also have chiral symmetry breaking, but it's broken by basically the boundary condition that in the infrared, not by the some bulk field, the mass.
And the bulk gauge field, where they come from?
So it's come from the gauge field living on the 8 and the 8 bar holes.
Yeah, do I remember correctly when Schiffman, Weinstein, Zakharov considers this QCD some rules? In this correlation function, for example, of two currents, part of the contribution is divergent, it seems. And then it seems subtracted this part of the contribution, and there were some uncertainties. But in your case, you somehow do have some regularization for this part of the contribution, or maybe I don't understand.
So there is this, in the SVG sum rule, there is this. You have to model the dimensionary part of the correlation. So you model that by a row pole plus some continuum.
Correct.
And then there is a when you do the matching, there is a parameter called, we call it M square, which is the scale at which you do the matching between OBE and some of the resonances. And here, this matching is done automatically for you. Mm-hmm. When you choose the metric, you don't have to do any matching.
Are there any more questions? Let's thank our speaker again.